Welcome to the Blue Collar Zen Podcast, recorded here at the Detroit Zen Center. Welcome back to the podcast, and today Sunim is going to read a story from the works of Po Chu-i. Po Chu-i was a Taoist practitioner and a very famous poet from the 8th century in China. And today, the book Sunim is reading from was translated by David Hinton. And the title of the story is The Man with a Broken Arm.
The Old Man from Xinfeng with a Broken Arm. A frail and ancient man from Xinfeng, 88 years old, hair and eyebrows white as fresh snow. He slowly makes his way toward the inn's front gate, leaning on a great-great-grandson, his left arm over the boy's shoulder, his right broken at his side. If you ask this old man how many years his arm's been broken, if you ask how it happened, an arm broken like that, he'll say, "When I was born at my home village in the district of Xinfeng, it was an age of sage rule, never a hint of wartime campaigns. So I grew up listening to the flutes and songs of the pear garden, knowing nothing at all about spears and flags, bows and arrows. Then suddenly, in the Tian Pao Rhine, they began building armies, and for every three men in every household, one was taken away, taken and hurried away. And can you guess where they all went? To Yunnan, a march 5 months and 10,000 miles long. A march everyone kept talking about. How you face the Lu River and malarial mists that rise and drift when pepper blossoms fall. How great armies struggled across the river's seething floodwaters, and before they make it across, two or three in ten are drowned. North of home, south of home, wailing filled villages everywhere. Sons torn from mothers and fathers. Husbands torn from wives. For people knew what it meant to make war on southern tribes. 10 million soldiers are sent away, and not one comes back alive. It was all so long ago. I was hardly even 24 back then. But my name was listed on the rolls at the Department of War. So in the depths of night, careful to keep my plan well hidden, I stole away, found a big rock, and hacked my arm until it broke. Now, too lame to draw a bow or lift banners and flags into the wind, I escaped. They didn't send me off to fight their war in Yunnan. Of course, it was far from painless. The bone shattered and the muscles torn. But I'd found a way to go back and settle quietly in my village. Now 60 years have come and gone since I broke this arm. I gave up a limb, it's true. But I'm still alive, still in one piece. Though even now, on cold, dark nights full of wind and rain, I'm sleepless all night long with pain and still awake at dawn. Sleepless with pain, but free of regrets, for I'm the only man in my district who lived to enjoy old age. If I hadn't done it, I'd have ended where the Lou River begins. A dead body, my spirit adrift, and my bones abandoned there. Just one of 10,000 ghosts drifting above the southern graves, gazing toward their home, all grief-torn and bleeding, bleeding. When such elders speak, how can we ignore them? Haven't you heard the story of Sung Kai Fu, prime minister in the Kai Yuan reign? How he nurtured peace by refusing to reward frontier victories. Haven't you heard the story of Yang Kyo-chung, prime minister in Tianpao, how he launched frontier campaigns to flatter the emperor? How the people were wild with anger before he won anything? Just ask him. Ask the old man from Xinfeng with the broken arm.
Sunim, I feel like I can hear the compassion in your voice when you're reading that story. And I wonder if you can, if war and that kind of suffering that humans take on and basically in such ignorance and aggression, if you could talk about maybe what that's had to do with your choice in becoming a monk and a Zen monk specifically.
Well, as I've aged and reflect back on my life as a very young boy, I lost an uncle, not directly to the war, although he was an MIA. When he came back, he was badly damaged, had a heart condition. Couldn't get compensation from the government, even though he had served admirably. And he eventually, because he couldn't even pass physicals to get a job, and he was a big, strong man, all state basketball and football at Highland Park High School in the 20s, ended up dying, frozen to death, fetching firewood. And he was maybe my closest uncle. And a half-brother who never seemed right when he came back from that Second World War. And I watched his marriage fail and his children completely in disarray as a result of the family life. And then into my own adulthood in college, I had friends that were drafted right out of college, and I don't recall any that actually died, but I recall one who lost his vision. And others that came back completely disturbed by the whole idea of yet another war, this one called the Vietnam War, where we lost 58,000 lives. And in this man's lifetime, when they say 10 million men left, none of whom returned, you realize the endless wars, no matter what generation it's in. This story is from about 2,200 years ago. And here it is that many years later, and we haven't learned that war devastates both sides. There are no winners in war. And really, the winners are the ones that stand up and say, like some of my friends did, I never had to because I didn't get drafted. That they weren't going. And in one case in particular, a very close friend had to flee to Canada, where he stayed in exile until almost 20 years later when he was finally pardoned. And during that time, he couldn't dare cross back into his own country, whether his mother and father passed or other friends. It was well known that the government staked those places out for what they called deserters and would arrest them and jail them. And the great heavyweight fighter, Muhammad Ali, refusing to go and fight a war that had nothing to do with the war he had been fighting in his life right here in America with very little attention given to it, and served in the prime of his career a jail sentence. These were the heroes in my generation that didn't go to war, that stood up for what they believed in. And I don't mean a religion. I don't mean some other principle other than taking another life is never going to be considered right except by people that are demanding that you take someone else's life. A human left to their own devices that was at all aware of what they were doing, how could they ever take a human life?
Thank you, Sonam. So here we are in 2024, and people don't want any more war. And so could you open up for us how we begin addressing that in a way that actually is going to make a difference?
Well, I mean, to me, war starts because the leadership wants a war. And they feel they've been pushed where the only recourse is war. I was alive when Pearl Harbor was attacked in December of 1941. I was just a baby. But that brought us into the Second World War, and that kind of justified it the same way that 9/11 justified or attempted to justify going into Iraq. And so I think we can always find a justification for doing that. And I'm a monk. I'm not a politician or even a social worker, because I think all of that is looking at trying to control things that are not controllable. They're always changing. But if you're a Zen monk, then your interest is in what isn't changing. We call it the unchangeable. We also call it the Buddha. We also call it the one mind. We also call it the Dharma. These are all names describing what's unchanging. And once that's touched, the unchanging are not going to interfere with the right of others to live their lives, whether in our own country or abroad. And I don't anticipate that enough people will take sincere interest in that to make any difference. And I have no illusions of grandeur in thinking that will happen, but I can guarantee that this is a path that literally relieves the peace of mind that even your own life of this body and this individual mind is simply something that is going to change, and we know that from birth. Even though we may not think about it as an early adult, as an adult until later life, this body, this ideal of an individual self that in Zen we call it an illusion, becomes more clear that it is illusory and it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And we're right back to that unchanging principle that can't be intellectualized and resolve your peace of mind. It must be directly experienced.
Thank you, Sunam. Yeah, there's a clear parallel there that I can see between fighting against your own impermanence, you know, the aging process. I mean, that's a huge business now, is, you know, people trying to reverse aging or postpone aging. So clearly underlying that is a fear of aging, a desire not to age, which I guess I'm calling there kind of a fighting against aging. And
everybody loses.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But the parallel between that fight against your own aging, your own impermanence, seems to be directly related to the fight we're willing to take on against another human being. Would you say that underneath all of this, whether it's an act of war against another human willing to take another person's life, and then the act of war against your own impermanence, that underneath all of that seems to be a sort of unexamined level of fear of the unknown? I got to stop this aging process. I'm going to do whatever it takes to stop this aging process. They seem to be sort of in the same arena. And so is that our basic situation, Sunam, that we're contaminated by fear?
Look, we have historical examples of people that literally were persecuted, some that died, some that didn't die but were fully persecuted and suffered, rather than go to war.
Right.
But that's a handful.
That's just a handful.
And clearly, if you don't have peace of mind,
yeah,
the war then is in your mind. In other words, that's where the struggle starts. And at the political level, geopolitical level, it can be brought out in the form of war or devastation on, like in this country, the middle class, the poor people. In this country,
yeah,
we can be talking about food deserts with more food wasted and thrown away than could feed more than just our country, but we still have people starving in our own cities. Now I happen to be at our hermitage and just reading this morning how 30% of the people in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan, are living in a food desert.
Right.
And there's been a lot of interest in doing something about that. And I go, hooray, that's a great thing, because it's people thinking about the people that don't have anything and helping them learn how to grow it, learn how to know what it is like to eat properly, and all of the stuff that goes along with that. But what we're talking about here is a mental state of peace of mind where you're not thinking about needing therapists and needing all the things that humans acquire in the course of a lifetime to try to make them feel better about their lives, when from a Zen point of view, you've got everything going for you as a human being.
Right.
Countless times in the readings that I've shared with people, that I've given to people, it says always the same thing. There is no difference between Buddhas and sentient beings. It's just that sentient beings don't know that, and Buddhas do.
So it sounds like your interest is in helping people, if they're interested, helping people see that.
Well, I'm a Zen monk. That's my work.
Yeah. Or not the quickest, but what is the most effective way that someone who does have a sincere interest in ending? You know, one of the very first things I heard from you when I was a teenager and I met you for the first time and came to one of your Dharma talks, I remember a young woman raising her hand and asking. She was very concerned about war. And she was asking about, you know, how can you end war in the world? How can doing meditation practice, what impact would that have in the world? And you answered, you said, well, if you want to have any influence in terms of war in the world, you have to start by ending the war inside your own mind.
Right.
And I remember that hit me like an arrow in the heart. So if someone does have that sincere desire to and sees the truth of that statement, that war begins inside of me, then how do you overcome that? What is the first step or the path forward out of this perpetual, kind of this or that?
Yeah, when you conflict? First ask the question, I want to think about this in terms of not Zen only. Obviously, it includes Zen. I think if a human being wants to be successful in this world, they have to find, and I would call it primarily, a spiritual leader of some school and follow their guidance. So that surrender, I think, I'm not an expert on all religions, but I think a common approach would be to surrender yourself to something higher than yourself. And that's really hard for Americans.
Yeah.
But it's essential, and it's definitely the first step. Now you can be taught. You're kind of bringing an empty container to the situation and saying, I'm surrendering. I don't know what to do. I don't know how to live my life. I don't know what matters and what doesn't matter. All of the things that people think and feel can come out when they surrender.
So it sounds like, in that case, what I feel like you are suggesting, or what I hear you suggesting, is that you need to find someone that your intuition tells you has overcome this war within themselves.
Well, I think you have to trust whoever you're surrendering to.
Yeah.
Like in the Catholic Church, which I have maybe more from it, you surrender to God.
Right.
You surrender to Jesus Christ.
Right.
These represent something bigger than yourself. That, to me, is a wonderful thing.
Right.
And it's not unlike what you have to do in any other religion.
Right.
Surrendering matters.
Right.
When you don't surrender, the question would be, why not?
What are
you holding back?
Yeah, reminds me of what folks with addiction to drugs or alcohol encounter when they go to go to meetings with AA or NA, that their first thing they are expected to do is to admit that they have a problem.
Well, that they have something that's more powerful than they are.
Yeah, and that they need help. and yeah. that they need to surrender to a higher power.
Which is generally the condition of Americans
right.
That
right.
want to think because they can make a lot of money,
right.
get the best-looking spouse.
Yeah, right. What advice do you give? Because I think a lot of that inability to surrender comes from a place where you're afraid to trust people that have authority and power, because clearly there have been a lot of situations where individuals have abused that power.
Yeah, I understand that. I think that I can only reflect on my own situation in that regard, and that is that I think trust is based on trusting yourself that you can be all right in any situation. And when it comes to a religion, they don't lock you in rooms.
Right.
Like at some point when the trust is broken,
you leave.
You yeah. can fully leave.
Right.
But recognize that when you leave, it isn't now you can't trust anyone. It means
yeah.
that isn't going to work for you. So you have to keep looking, because if you don't find that kind of guidance, we have all the ample evidence that the alternative is not working except in a very tiny minority of people
right.
in this world.
Right.
All you have to do is go to any old age home, and they all are happy to talk because they're lonely. And if you say to them, tell me about the meaning of life. It sends a chill through you. It's so shallow.
Yeah. And so it sounds like what you're sharing here, Sunim, is that you have to start by revealing yourself to someone that you trust. That your intuition tells you this person, you know, may not be perfect, but in terms of having ended the war within their own
yeah.
heart or mind.
You stepped it up to
yeah.
now the revealing part. You asked me, what's the beginning? I said the beginning is a surrender. You're going too far now with that.
What does it mean to surrender? What do you mean by that then? It sounds like I'm using the word.
You're surrendering to something bigger than yourself. But doesn't mean suddenly you can reveal everything about yourself.
But surrender is a pretty big word. I think of surrender as someone that's down on the floor and their head is bowed and they're saying, do with me what you will.
What I'm telling you about that is that's an act of surrender.
Mm.
It's going to take time to really surrender.
Mm.
But that's the starting point, and that's what you ask about.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how every culture seems to have a different approach, but you shared with us once a book called The Zen Way by Irmgard Schlogel, which is an Austrian woman who spent time in the Japanese Zen monastery. And she was talking about how when the young novitiates come up to the monastery to be accepted, the first thing they do is spend, you know, a couple of days outside the entrance to the temple in a full bow, just totally kneeling down on the ground, basically demonstrating through their external appearance that I'm humble and I'm willing to listen.
They're surrendering.
They're surrendering through their physically. You know, we don't know exactly what's going on inside, but that's their conduct. And then when you go to Korea and you want to enter the monastery, the first thing you do is go through a hengja period where you're demonstrating to the community, I'm going to work for this community. I'm going to scrub the floors, up early.
I think that to use the same word, you're surrendering to the community.
Yeah.
Like you're supposed to serve everyone in the community from the lowest to the highest exactly the same way.
Interesting, yeah.
And so there's multiple things going on there. It's too yeah. complicated
but this
to
is
talk
a non,
about that.
But this is a non-negotiable part of what I hear you teaching here is if you really want to overcome war in the world, if you really want to help war, you've got to become a person who can surrender. And then that, you know, that may or may not have an impact at the larger level of the world, but that's what it's going to take. The way to overcome war is that individuals have to learn how to surrender.
And I think that if you don't trust yourself, then you're not going to be able to surrender. Because it's saying, I'm willing to give my trust to another person because I trust myself so deeply.
Right.
But if they say to me, like if somebody came to me and did that, like you, and I said, you've demonstrated complete trust in me, Myungju Sunim. So today, what I want you to do is go down to the Ambassador Bridge and walk out in the middle and leap in.
Yeah, right.
At that point, you should recognize, because you haven't lost your ability to rationalize, to discriminate, like, right. That's not what I'm here for.
So you're making a distinction here between surrendering and being stupid. So
for sure.
Could you help open that up? Because I do think this is a point that's really, really a hang up for us in the West. This idea of having a spiritual teacher, having a spiritual community, surrendering to anything is really hard. Even our spouse, people
right.
we want to surrender to.
Right.
Like, can you talk about this a little bit more, Sunim? Mm-hmm. Surrender versus being blind and dumb.
Okay. I think that even blind and dumb people on Wednesday night can make 108 prostrations, which is an act of surrendering.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that's where your mind is. But I think that you've reported to me, I think even maybe as a little surprise to you, people really like the prostrations.
Yeah.
Because it's moving in the right direction. And I think every religion uses bowing in some way.
Yeah.
Because that is the act of surrendering. So I've always told you, and I'll never not tell you, that behavior comes before the mental change, because we can discipline our body to make those bows.
Yeah.
And if we make enough of them, that behavior will, in fact, begin to affect our mental well-being. And that's why people in just one time there will tell you, I really like doing that. That's the thimble. It's already started. All they've got to do is continue.
And it's interesting, Sunim. Another thing that is occurring to me is that this, you know, surrendering, that like deliberate action is almost the antidote to aggression or war. Like if you, like last time, during the last podcast reading that we did was around cutting up the ox. And I remember there was a passage there where the ox cutter said when he got to a particularly difficult part, like the joint, he would slow down and become extremely deliberate. And it feels like when you're ready to strike against someone, you're ready to go to war with yourself or another human being, that's a difficult part. That's like the ox cutter getting to a joint. And our tendency as a human is to speed up, drop a bomb, cut their head off. But what it seems like you're prescribing here, and that we would be learning this from a teacher, from a tradition, would be at that point, when you're really ready to become aggressive and do damage, that is the point where you really have to back down, slow down, and pay attention. Would you say that's right, Sunim?
Well, you said a lot. I think I'm going to let you rest with whether it's right or not. You just drew too many from too many places for my thinking.
Yeah.
You asked the fundamental question, what's first? And I said surrender. And that's enough to get started with. And I don't want to lose the fact that I'm making sure that people understand to something that you can trust is higher than yourself, the full expanse of, say, the religion.
Yeah.
But also that then you have a mentor that you're at least provisionally giving your complete trust to, because you trust yourself to know when that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And you can leave. And I instruct people, I've probably been doing this for the last 10 years. If when you become my student and you think that I have an agenda for you other than hoping to help you reach your maximum potential, which in Zen is called realizing that you're already Buddha.
Yeah.
then again, you cannot trust that person. And we're all the time trusting people that have, I would say, a vested interest in us doing what they want.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that's even ascribed to people that haven't got a bone in their body of wanting something from you. But it's you have never been in a situation
right.
before where either you or the person you're doing business with hasn't wanted something from
yeah,
you.
Right.
So coming to, again, a religious tradition where whether it's a Catholic priest or a Muslim imam, they cannot want you to do anything, even including practice their religion.
Right.
Like, that's got to be from you.
Right. The opposite of transactional.
Yeah.
Well, Sunam, thank you. Thank you for your time.